Hello. On this week's program, we make our second visit this year to the Jersey Shore. Susan Lewis finds out how Wildwood has co-opted the term for a 1950s music style to describe its architecture from the same period. We take a walk through Lucy. A six-story-high elephant-shaped building has been an attraction in Margate for more than a century. Jason Pfeiffer explores the world of professional sand sculpting ahead of Cape May's annual sand sculpting contest. And we visit the Noise Museum in the final days of an acclaimed exhibition of hunting decoys. That's all ahead this morning. Down the shore, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
All along the South Jersey shore, ocean waves lap at flat, white, sandy beaches. But once you shake out the towels, pack up the buckets, shovels, chairs and umbrellas, you start to realize that each shore town has its own distinctive character, personality and look. Atlantic City has its casino glitz, Cape May with its Victorian charm, and somewhere in between, Wildwood, or more accurately the cluster of communities known as the Wildwoods, is marketing an identity beyond the amusement parks and bars, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
Earth Angel, will you be mine? My darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool in love with you.
That's the Penguins' Earth Angel, said to be the first pure doo-wop record. It blends pop melodies and the lyrical innocence of the 1950s with the emotional syntax of gospel and R&B. Now Wildwood is staking its claim to doo-wop architecture. That's what a group of civic-minded Wildwood residents decided to call the style of buildings, particularly motels, that went up during Wildwood's building boom of the same time, says Charles Schumann, a member of the Doo-Wop Preservation League.
The war ended. People had money in their pockets. They bought a car. They could drive to Wildwood. They needed places to stay, which developed the motel districts. And it was all done in the 50s and 60s and followed the design that was popular then.
But as time passed, the charm of these funky motels faded for succeeding generations of vacationers. By the 1990s, many of Wildwood's over 300 doo-wop-style motels were gone or in danger of being swept away by new construction. An architect named Steve Eisenhower helped change the tide, according to a protege of his, architect Richard Stokes. Stokes says that when Eisenhower studied Wildwood, he discovered, academically speaking, a plethora of 1950s design and helped support the case that this architecture could be a civic asset.
He got the resort to rethink about how they saw the motels, the buildings, in that it was a more important piece of American history that should not be thrown in the trash heap like a lot of other such places.
The Doo-Wop Preservation League rallied with a mission to protect Wildwood's distinctive 50s urban landscape, just as Cape May had nurtured its Victorian-era roots. And the label Doo-Wop? Chuck Schumann says that name came up when the Preservation League joined with the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts to put together its first tour of Wildwood.
We had to have a way of describing that architect because we weren't really pleased with some of the other terms, Jetson and etc. And after doing a little research, we realized that the term doo-wop was used in background music from Philadelphia during the 50s. So we added it to our definition of the architect in Wildwood.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell.
If you're wondering how soulful harmonies translate to glass and steel, the architecture is described by Richard Stokes as mid-century modern.
California, it's known as Googie style. And, Miami, it's known as Mimo. So every locality sort of has its own name for this fun 1950s vintage optimistic modern architecture.
In Wildwood, this 50s optimism was expressed in motels that played with zany loud colors like aqua and purple, unusual shapes, bright signage, and futuristic themes, like the Astronaut Hotel, or exotic places you might like to visit if your budget didn't limit you to the Jersey Shore. And so motels sprung up with names like the Tahiti, the Singapore, the Royal Hawaiian. Stokes says that many of the owners had Miami Beach in mind, modified in terms of cost because of Wildwood's shorter season. And whichever theme took hold, the layout of each motel, or motor hotel, paid homage to the object of America's newest passion and the love affair that made all of this development possible in the first place.
It's all about the car here. People had newly purchased cars, and so these motels actually showed off the car. People wanted to park right in front of their units. They didn't want to hide it.
Ilan Zingman Leith, a former board member of the Duop Preservation League, says that the car was the focus of a whole new sensibility.
The freedom of not taking the train to go on vacation, which is what people did before World War II, was very new, and it was a new class of middle-class people. They were nouveau riche, and they liked to show off, and they had decorations. Plain, simple, tasteful was not the style of the 50s.
Leith now sits on the board of the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts and is curator of this summer's exhibit on Duop style at the center's Carriage House. He says that his interest is in social history, and the exhibit relates the Duop design to the whole way of life at the time.
1950s music, 1950s television, 1950s politics, the Red Scare, integration, all these parts of life showed up in movies, in music, and really showed up in furniture and in architecture too. This futuristic aesthetic was a part of the 50s and was really a turning away from early American and historical stuff that was before World War II.
And so the Duop preservationists press on. The National Trust for Historic Preservation named Wildwood's Duop Motels to its 2006 list of most endangered historic places. The Duop Preservation League has published a book on how to create and maintain a Duop style and issues guidelines for developers in the hopes that voluntary compliance will nudge the community forward, or backward, but in a new way. Because the goal was not to go back in time and replicate exactly the facilities of the 50s, but rather to save a slice of social history and adapt it for the future. And Chuck Schumann says that thanks to the efforts of the Duop Preservation League, the new Duop is not just limited to motel renovations. Other businesses are catching the wave.
The Acme has just built a brand new Acme, and it's Duop. The building's done in light blue and white, an off-color blue, the Duop blue. Wawa altered their exterior design of the building to be Duop with lots of stainless steel. Commerce Bank built a brand new bank in Wildwood with a great Duop sign, lots of neon.
So what's all this have to do with its musical namesake? Maybe not a lot, but just enough. With common roots, a shared history, and an enduring enthusiasm for exuberant fun, which is perhaps what the shore, or at least this part of it, is all about.
She wore blue velvet.
WRTI, Susan Lewis.
Bluer than velvet was the night.
This fall, the Wildwood Preservation League plans to open a new museum dedicated to the doo-wop style. In the meantime, the exhibition at the Carriage House Gallery of the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts runs through September 3rd.
She wore blue velvet, and as the night danced slowly by, warmer than May, her tender sighs. Love was high, and I still can see blue velvet. I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
When you think of wildlife at the Jersey Shore, you're probably thinking seagulls and maybe a cat or two pacing the docks. But one of the most famous animals at the Jersey Shore is an elephant. Standing 65 feet tall, weighing 90 tons, is Lucy the elephant. And she's old, 125 years to be exact. But this doesn't mean she's lost her spark.
Lucy is so unique. There's nothing like her else anywhere else on Earth.
Richard Halfand is executive director of Lucy, who, all right, is not actually a living, breathing pachyderm, but she is actually a National Historic Landmark. The technical name for a building shaped like an animal is zoomorphic architecture, and Lucy is the country's oldest surviving example of this. What may seem weird about Lucy by today's real estate standards is why a giant elephant made of wood and tin stands on precious beachfront property. Richard Helfand explains that Lucy came into being as a result of a 19th century marketing scheme. Margate was not yet a town, and the land was underdeveloped and fairly undiscovered by tourists. A Philadelphia real estate entrepreneur named James Lafferty came up with a plan to change all this.
He owned this land, and he came up with a gimmick of building a mammoth elephant, fashioned after P.T. Barnum's Jumbo, to lure prospective land buyers down from Atlantic City, which was booming in the late 1800s, to sell off his holdings. And that's how Lucy came to be.
And it worked. People came to this part of what was then South Atlantic City to see the six-story building shaped like an elephant. Lafferty's real estate office was at the bottom of Lucy, and prospective customers could climb up the stairway in her leg, walk around her stomach and head outside to the howdah, the viewing area on her back. From Lucy's back, they could survey the land that was for sale. The young real estate entrepreneur quickly sold off his property, but Lucy's work wasn't yet done. Her creator did build two other elephants in his career. As a matter of fact, no one else could. He had a patent on buildings shaped like animals for 17 years. One elephant stood 12 stories high in Coney Island. The other, the smallest of the three, was in Cape May. Lucy is now the only survivor. Lucy remained peering out at the Atlantic Ocean long after beachfront property was a tough sell. She was a private home and a tavern, but in her longest incarnation from 1904 to 1962, she was a tourist attraction. But like many divas before her, as times changed, Lucy had some tough luck.
The area was in a bad way. Atlantic City was in a major decline by then. It was really a very desolate, desperate town, and so goes Atlantic City, so goes the region. And Lucy was actually condemned by the building department for the city of Margate as being unsafe for people to go through. So it sat dormant from 62 to 69 and just continued to rot.
No longer wanting to deal with a deteriorating 65-foot elephant in a town going south, Lucy's owners moved to Florida, selling the land where Lucy stood to a developer and donating the elephant to the town of Margate. In 1970, Lucy was carefully moved two blocks south to beachfront property owned by the city. Moving a 90-ton elephant, even just two blocks, is quite a feat. As Lucy's tour director, Marsha Lee Gowdy, explains.
She held up well, even though she was so decrepit and in sad shape, but her tongue fell out. And so we have the original tongue in the window there for everyone to see.
And there it is, a giant pink tongue about as large as a child's sled. We're inside the belly of Lucy, which serves as a museum. On the flesh-colored walls, there are black and white photos documenting Lucy's past and her many stages of restoration. Walk over to her head and you can peek through Lucy's eyes, which are windows, and you see what Lucy sees, which incidentally is a really fantastic view of the Atlantic Ocean.
Each year, tens of thousands of visitors of all ages come to see Lucy.
An 8-minute video plays inside the belly of the beast, offering more information than you ever thought you'd need to know about an elephant-shaped building. In the summer, there are tours every 30 minutes, but hard times are not over for New Jersey's favorite elephant, as Marsha Lee Gowdy admits.
Lucy's a work in progress because she needs constant maintenance. And she's once again beautiful, thanks to the Save Lucy Committee.
And for Executive Director Rich Helfand, the cost of maintaining Lucy is a constant battle, which he doesn't always feel he's winning.
There are monuments, there are museums, there are lighthouses, there are old historic buildings, but there's only one elephant building on Earth. She's very special. She's very, very unique. And the fact that so many people take her for granted and don't support her as they should to have a national monument right here in their backyard is kind of disheartening.
Lucy is operated by the non-profit Save Lucy Committee, and the beachfront property she stands on is owned by the city of Margate. Although the two don't always see eye to eye, for now Lucy is safe. And Helfand says the Save Lucy Committee will do what they can to keep her this way.
Lucy stands for a lot of things to us. Lucy is about history. She's a testament to what man can do with imagination. She's a piece of Americana. She's a part of the fabric of America. You know, when you look through her eyes, it's a porthole into our past. And she's a beacon into our future of what you can do with imagination and determination. And she's also a symbol of what almost was lost, because she came this close to being, you know, a victim of the wrecking ball.
Down in Margate by the sea, we can make a
You can find Lucy the Elephant at 9200 Atlantic Avenue, Margate. She's open from Monday through Saturday, 10 to 8, and Sundays, 10 to 5.
Lucy the Elephant, my love to you.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
When you go to the shore, it's hard to avoid it. Sand is seemingly everywhere. Sometimes the gritty stuff can be an annoyance. It makes its way into our shoes, pockets, suitcases, and cars, somehow managing to stick around for weeks after a trip to the shore. At the same time, most people can't help but also have some affection for sand. Really, let's face it, wouldn't long walks on the beach just be a short clamber over the rocks if sand wasn't a part of the equation? Children spend hours playing in it at the water's edge, burying themselves and their parents, and crafting castles of sand. But the digging, piling, and patting of the little grains isn't just for kids. Many so-called grown-ups can't stay away from it either. If you're in Cape May next weekend, you might bump into one man who's especially passionate about playing in the sand. Matt Long is a professional sand sculptor, and this Friday he's overseeing the 7th annual Cape May Sand Sculpting Contest. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer recently spent a few hours with the New York-based sand sculptor to talk about his summertime obsession.
There's a little water in there.
On a clear, beautiful, but windy day in Cape May, New Jersey, Matt Long toils away with a shovel, bucket of water, and an array of small sand sculpting tools as he explains how to create the foundation of a potentially crumbly sculpture.
You want to make sure that it gets in there uniform. You don't want a dry spot to show up on you where it's loose. You'll start carving and it'll fall down. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to add sand to an area later.
It's obvious that Matt Long has given sand sculpting considerable thought and observation. He's been making sand creations for about 12 years.
But I can honestly say that I did not make anything worth looking at till about 2000, and that's about 6 years ago. And since then, I've appeared on Regis and Kelly and the Today in New York show, and I've sculpted for the PGA Tour and lots of other places, Atlantis Casino down in the Caribbean, and I get hired pretty regular to do this. To have fun.
Matt Long and his family, who are from New York City, have been coming to Cape May in the summer for decades, nearly 30 years. He considers the Victorian beach town a second home. But although the shore has been a regular part of his life for many years, Long wasn't captivated by the art of sand sculpture until the mid-90s.
And on this next beach over, I was out for a stroll one day, and, I saw an amazing sight. There was a guy in a raft, and he's paddling away from a shark that was eating the back of the raft, and it was all done in sand, and I was just absolutely hooked. I went back to the blanket with my family, and I started making the most ridiculous, absurd-looking castles that I was so proud of. And they would move far away from me on the beach, And that's the truth. And then I got a little bit better over the first 4 or 5 years, but it was still pretty embarrassing. And I went to a professional sand sculpting contest, and I saw a professional do it. And once I saw the tricks that they used, it took right off. I found my creative niche in sand.
When it's not beach season, Long's full-time job is restoring wood in old buildings. His expertise with woodwork comes in handy with his sand work. Soon after taking up his sand hobby, he discovered there aren't very many specialized tools for sand sculpting out there. Many sculptors end up using kitchen utensils. So Long decided to design his own tools, carving the prototypes out of wood. After years of experimenting with and tweaking a set of 6 tools, he now sells sand paraphernalia to people on the side. They're called Can You Dig It sand tools. Long says seeing other people become excited about the art form is one of the most thrilling aspects of doing his sculptures every summer. He often holds free clinics for people on the beach and organizes an amateur sand sculpting contest every August in Cape May.
We probably get upwards of 1,000 people entering. They'll come create everything from cameras to sofas and living room settings. Castles are a big part of it. Fish, horses, lobsters, you name the sea animal or anything. And
I guess we call it a contest more than a competition, but it's just a great day out. Everybody wins.
In watching masses of people of all skill levels trying their hand with sand, Long says a common piece of advice he has for aspiring sculptors is to learn patience.
When anyone asks me, how did you get started in this, the first answer is a failure to be able to sit still and do nothing at the beach. So there shows the lack of patience, but when you're actually doing it, it's very focused, and you learn to take your time. You can't rush this.
Of course, learning the craft of sculpting sand takes more than just patience. There are many little tricks to master. Simple things like selecting the right sand and knowing how much water to use. And then there's the job of simply envisioning what to sculpt. Long has created a great variety of forms in the past, many close to his heart.
The sculptures I'm most proud of, I do each year right at Ground Zero for the fire department who lost so many lives. There's a tunnel to tower run that remembers one specific fireman who ran through the tunnel on 9/11. Yeah, I knew him. And, you know, and all the firemen who died on that day. And it's a great day in New York City, and I've sculpted three or four times there now. I did fire trucks. I did about a 50-foot-long helmet one year, and last year I did a very large American flag over a fire truck. Where do you come up with the ideas? They're tricky. I did Thomas the Tank Engine down here one time because there was a little boy carrying a Thomas the Tank Engine backpack, you know. So, okay, Thomas the Tank Engine today. You get your ideas from funny places.
Sand sculpture is something, maybe you could compare it to a performer who sings or plays music, in that it's kind of there, but eventually that sand sculpture is going to blow away. Do you have thoughts on that, kind of the ephemeral nature of it versus, you know, a painting or a stone sculpture?
Yeah. I've been asked this question a lot of times, you know, what about this zen-like quality to it, that it's there and it's gone? And in the very beginning, you know, I kind of wanted to hold on to them, and it's obviously impossible. You get used to it, and it's just part of it. You're not in an art form that's going to last. You create it. It's the most fun for spectators while it's going on, and you walk away. You walk away. I've had kids jump on them when I walked away from it myself before I was done, and that's a little distressing, but they're all going to go, you know, and you just really do, you do get used to it.
Matt Long adds that he wonders, if his sculptures did last, would he make as many as he does? Maybe this fleeting nature of the form is what brings the young at heart, like Matt Long, back year after year. As the summer fades, we really can't hang on to the smell of the ocean or the sensation of digging our toes into the sand. But the seashore itself does remain, waiting for a new season of sunbathers, swimmers, and indeed, sand sculptors.
Mr. Sandman, bum, 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 bum. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Give him two lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone.
Bum, 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 bum.
Don't have nobody to call my own.
Bum, 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 bum.
Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer with sand sculptor Matt Long. The 7th annual Cape May Amateur Sand Sculpting Contest takes place this Friday at the 2nd Street Jetty and Cove Beach in Cape May from 9 a.m. until 1 in the afternoon.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring us, please, 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 Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
For those in the mood to look at art, seashore shops and galleries show plenty of beach scenes and seascapes. But if you're willing to venture inland just a bit, there's a fully fledged art museum waiting. Just 15 minutes from Atlantic City, nestled next to the Edwin B. Forsyth Wildlife Refuge, is the Noise Museum, which has nothing to do with sound. It's Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, named after its founders, Ethel and Fred Noyes. The Wildlife Refuge is a haven for birdwatchers and the perfect backdrop for this picturesque museum. Built in 1983, it feels more like a well-designed vacation home. A wall of glass frames the lake like a work of art, and the sun streams in from the skylight, giving the room a healthy glow that many sterile, boxy museum spaces lack. The founders, Fred and Ethel Noyes, started out with an antique shop. After some success, they began collecting very large antiques. Over time, they purchased old buildings and moved them onto their property, creating a kind of quaint historic village. In 1974, they sold this cluster of buildings known as Historic Smithville for no small sum.
And it is common knowledge that the proceeds from that sale netted $7 million.
Gay Walling is the executive director of the Noyes Museum, which was created with the proceeds from that sale. Historic Smithville Village still stands about a mile away. The Noyes Museum collects and exhibits American fine and folk art, with a heavy focus on artists from New Jersey. Fred Noyes was an artist as well as a collector of hunting decoys, which are considered a sort of folk art. In the early years of the museum, his large collection of hand-carved bird replicas was on permanent display. As the museum's general collection grew, the decoys were put in storage and brought out every couple of years. This summer, in an exhibition titled The Art of Decoys Revisited, Fred Noyes' collection is on view once again, alongside contemporary installations, prints and photographs that pay tribute to the idea of decoys, whether taken literally or figuratively. Museum curator A.M. Weaver says she gave the artists a simple mandate.
To present works that relate some way to the concept of decoy or the term as it's defined as a verb or a noun.
The results include some humorous works, such as a duck made from duct tape, and some pieces of international acclaim. There are prints by Jasper Johns presented as decoys of his original paintings. They're aptly entitled Decoy 1 and Decoy 2. Other artists use the decoy concept even more loosely, with some creating works as lures for artificionados.
A lot of artists are using it as objects or installations that will attract the visitors. So rather than the hunter attracting a duck, it's the artist attracting the audience.
And the Noyes Museum is ready for that audience. As Gay Walling explains, the fact that the museum sits in a quiet, picturesque setting is both a perk and a problem.
A struggle is our visibility because we are set back off of the main route, even though we're within walking distance of Route 9. There are signs, you know, directing you here. It's still a location that you don't happen upon.
For those who do hunt it down, the Noyes Museum offers an aesthetic change of pace from the sun, sand, and the boardwalk clamor. The Art of Decoys Revisited runs through August 2nd. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Marjorie Preston and Karen DeRosa. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.